From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And we are now 21 days into a partial government shutdown, a crisis that started over a fight about a border wall. Today, federal workers who have nothing to do with that issue will miss their first paychecks.
And President Trump is weighing advice that he act unilaterally to end the shutdown by declaring a national emergency, something that would be challenged in court. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us today. Jose Diaz-Balart, news anchor for Telemundo and NBC. He's in Miami. Hi, Jose.
How are you? Good to see you.
Good to have you. And Chad Pergram, Capitol Hill senior producer for Fox News. Hi, Chad.
Gentlemen.
So, Chad, you are on Capitol Hill. There are no negotiations underway. Both sides entrenched. What is the mood? What is likely to happen?
Well, nobody really knows how to get out of this cul-de-sac here. And in just the past couple of minutes before we went on the air, the House of Representatives has approved the fourth spending bill that covers four of the seven outstanding spending areas here. This one dealt with the Department of Interior. The Democrats are trying to go through these seven appropriations bills and reopen these sections of the government. The vote here was 240 to 179. There were 10 Republican defections. Now, Democrats are trying to put pressure on Republicans to vote for these bills, but we've had votes of 10 Republicans, 12 Republicans, and 10 Republicans on each of these bills the past couple of days here, so they're not really getting much traction there. Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator from South Carolina, he was trying to cut a side deal, maybe get some more border wall funding and work out a more universal agreement on immigration and DACA. And he was sidelined yesterday by President Trump. Lindsey Graham said, quote, "I have never been more depressed about moving forward than I am now." This is really remarkable. Marco Rubio, the Republican senator from Florida, said that the problem here is that Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, Chuck Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate, and President Trump all think they're winning. And a lot of people think that nobody's winning in this.
All right. Well, Lindsey Graham says it is now time for President Trump to declare that national emergency because, as you say, there is no other way out of this impasse. Here's what House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that would mean.
I think he's going to have to answer to his own party on usurping that much power. But again, I'm not going down a path until we see what it is he's willing to do.
Jose, how much closer are we today to the president making that decision?
I think closer and closer. And meanwhile, people are suffering, not only the 800,000 federal workers who have directly been affected. I mean, you know, we're coming up on, 22 days coming up soon. And, for example, look, I'll give you an example. Miami International Airport has announced that they'll be closing one of their terminals this weekend so that TSA agents the ones that continue to go to work, even though they're not getting paid, can go to other terminals that are more, busy during this weekend. But we're, you know, this is happening at a time when people, 80% of the American people, don't have savings in their account to be able to withstand being unemployed. And so, this is happening, and it seems as though, as Chad was saying, I mean, neither the Republicans nor the Democrats seem willing to budge on this issue. And I don't know how anything can be solved.
You know, it's pretty clear that they can't find a way on Capitol Hill and with the administration out of this cul-de-sac. And I want to go back to one of my favorite quotes of all time. And it was from Harold Macmillan, who was the British prime minister back in the 50s, early 60s. And he was speaking at Oxford and was famously asked, "What's the most important factor in politics?" And he said, "Events, my dear boy, events. When you talk to people here on Capitol Hill and there is no obvious way out, they will concede to you that some sort of an event will be what resolves this."
Like that declaration?
That could be one event. It could be an international crisis. Mm. It could be, God forbid, some issue with the food supply. We've heard about the FDA not doing full food inspections, transportation issues, airline issues that we've discussed. It could be any one of those things. You know, when we had the shutdown in 2013 over Obamacare, what got people to the table was there was this wild car chase and shootout with the U.S. Capitol Police here. Mm. There were a couple of the officers who were injured in a minor fashion, and here they were working on the job, protecting the U.S. Capitol and not getting paid. And after that event happened, that got everybody back to the table, and they reopened the government just a couple of days
later. We were talking today about how this whole situation has completely changed the view that Americans have of the TSA. People are going up and hugging TSA agents as they go through the airport, thanking them for working without the promise of a paycheck, without a paycheck today. I just want to listen to something that President Trump said this week. He said that he'd never campaigned—well, of course, we're talking about this because he he wants Congress to pay for the wall. He says this week that he never campaigned on Mexico paying for the wall. Here he is.
When during the campaign, I would say Mexico's going to pay for it. Obviously, I never said this and I never meant they're going to write out a check.
Okay, you can go back to every rally that he held, but there's also this moment from a Fox town hall with Sean Hannity on April 13th, 2016. Listen.
100%.
They're not going to write us a check, but...
They'll pay. They'll pay in one form or another. They may even write us a check by the time they see what happened.
Chad, what about this? How can he say now that he never said that Mexico was going to pay for the wall?
Well, it isn't the first time where there's been inconsistencies in what the president has said. You know, in this whole idea that this new trade agreement that he has worked out with Canada and Mexico that would overtake NAFTA, there's been an agreement between the three countries here, but this has to be ratified by Congress. And they are nowhere near getting that through. These trade agreements are always dicey at best. Nobody really sees how they're going to go, you know, how they're going to get that through, if that's going to be the supply that gets things in there. You know, and at the end of the day, it comes down to what people are seeing on the ground. During that debate this morning in the House on the Interior Appropriations Bill, Jared Huffman, who's a Democrat from Northern California, the Bay Area, Marin County, he said maybe the president can get the wall from all the garbage that's piling up in these national parks. He said there should be enough there to be able to build a wall with that.
And nothing in this NAFTA 2.0 talks about money being allocated towards anything other than the NAFTA agreement.
Jose, big news in the Russia investigation this week. Former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen said he's going to testify publicly to the House Oversight Committee next month. And this is before he goes to prison for federal crimes, including making illegal payments to silence women during the 2016 presidential campaign and lying to Congress about the Trump Tower Moscow project. His legal advisor, Lanny Davis, spoke on MSNBC.
He wants an opportunity to at least tell the truth about what it was like working for a man in the private sector who lies, acts immorally or abusively, and has no barriers on ethics.
I predict we are going to be very busy in early February when this happens. A big day on Capitol Hill.
I also predict huge ratings for the television networks that decide to put this on, because this is going to be fireworks that one is going to be very interested to watch. And not only at the chair that Elijah Cummings is House Oversight Committee, but then, you know, Jerry Nadler is saying that he'd be interested as the chair of the Judiciary Committee to have Cohen testify afterwards. So it's going to be very interesting. I'm not sure how much more this is going to contribute to our knowledge of, Russian interference in the 2016 elections, but it certainly will make some very interesting news.
What about
the flip
other
side of that? Ahead, is, Jim. Does it live up to the hype? You know, at the end of the day, when Elijah Cummings announced the hearing yesterday, he was questioned about this in the hallways here at the Capitol by reporters, and he announced three hearings, including the Cohen hearing at once. Mm-hmm. He said, well, wait a minute. He said, these are just one of three hearings that we're having. Yeah. We're also having one on government transparency. We're also having one on prescription drugs.
Why don't you care about those?
Right. Yeah. Democrats realize that there's going to be, you know, peril in this if, A, it doesn't live up to the hype, or, B, it is so hyped up that everybody's focused on this and the Democrats are interpreted as overplaying their hand. That is a risk for the Democrats here.
What about the other big news in the Russia investigation this week, that former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort admitted in court filings that he shared campaign polling data with Russia-connected oligarchs? Here's Mark Warner, the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, on CNN.
What did Donald Trump know about this exchange of information? You know, did the Russians end up using this information in their efforts that took place later in the fall, where they tried using the Internet Research Agency and other bots and other automated tools on social media to suppress, for example, African-American vote?
So this is probably the closest thing, Jose, that we've heard to collusion. Yet Democrats remain cool on impeaching the president.
Yeah. Why would anybody working for a campaign share internal information with, someone not related to it? That's just very odd. And there's something really odd behind this. It's interesting because maybe that's what Manafort, his modus operandi was in his professional career. But if so, this is a guy that... pretty incredible to see this thing happening, you know?
What folks notice about the impeachment question, too, is that Nancy Pelosi has been here before. when she became the speaker back in 2007, one of the first things she said about, you know, calls on the left liberals to impeach President George W. Bush, she said impeachment is off the table. Now, she's been trying to douse those flames in her own caucus right now. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, even though they elected a lot of new liberal Democrats in the House of Representatives, there are also some conservative Democrats. I would look at Joe Cunningham from South Carolina. I would look at Jared Golden from Maine. Votes for impeachment or anything like that are not good votes for them. And that's why there's going to be, you know, this shoving match inside the Democratic Party of how to approach things with President Trump.
Well, and you know what will be interesting next week? William Barr's confirmation hearing to be the next attorney general. So we will probably hear how Democrats are going to approach asking him whether he'll protect that investigation.
Chad, isn't it amazing how we've come to a situation in this country when we're talking about this?
Yeah. Indeed. Jose Diaz-Balart, news anchor for Telemundo and NBC, and Chad Pergram, Capitol Hill senior producer for Fox News. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's new research this week that shows the world's ocean temperatures are rising faster than previously thought. The study published in the journal Science shows oceans warming up 40% faster than the estimate made by the UN 5 years ago. The study also notes that ocean temperatures have repeatedly set records for warmth in recent years, with 2018 expected to be the hottest yet. Joining us now is John Abraham, one of the co-authors of this new study. He's professor of thermal sciences at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. Professor, welcome.
Great to be with you.
So tell us more about what you found here.
Well, the key of climate change is in the oceans. And what we like to say is global warming is ocean warming. Because 93% of the global warming heat ends up in the oceans. So if you want to know what's going to happen to the world, you have to be measuring the oceans. And we collected not only our measurements, but measurements from other research groups, and everyone's telling the same story. The oceans are warming faster than we had previously thought, and this is bad news for the climate.
And why is it happening? Why is it happening so much faster than we thought before?
The reason why it's happening is because humans emit heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere, and that causes the Earth to warm. We've known that. We've known that for decades, but this is definitive proof about how fast the Earth is warming. And the key is, by knowing how fast it's warming now, it tells us what's going to happen in the future. What's new in our study is the way we took temperature measurements in the oceans to stitch together a picture of the entire ocean. I mean, you think about the oceans. They're huge. They cover about 70% of our planet. You can't just stick a thermometer out in the Pacific and figure out what's happening everywhere. You have to have sensors everywhere. And the way we stitched together all of these sensors to make a single number was really the novelty of this work.
So it's just better sensors, better data, essentially. We just weren't doing it the right way before, but in fact, the oceans may have been warming just this fast a few years ago.
Well, that's right. And what's interesting is in one of the tools that climate scientists use are models, which are computer calculations. And just a few years ago, in the last IPCC report, the measurement said the oceans were warming slower than the models. But now our new improved measurements are saying, hold on a second. The models were actually right. The higher warming was correct. And so what we've found out is the computer models had it right all along. And when you put more sensors spread out in the ocean, you get a better picture of what's happening. And it's worse than what we thought.
So when you look at the implications of this, you're talking about stronger storms. You're talking about effects on coastal areas. You're talking about effects on the coral reefs, which have already seen some serious problems in the last several years. What can be done to slow this down?
The thing that we need to do is use our energy more wisely and to make better use of renewable energy. So that means ramp up wind and solar power production and decrease fossil fuel production, so coal and petroleum-based energy. Now, the nice thing is we can do that without it costing us money. Today, wind and solar are equal to the cost of coal-based electricity. I live here in Minnesota, and I get all of my electricity because of solar panels on my roof. If I can do it in Minnesota, people in Texas and Florida and other southern states can do it as well, where they get more sunlight. So it just makes economic sense as well as environmental sense. Let's get our energy from sources that don't contribute to pollution. Let's save money and save the environment at the same time. It just makes sense.
The question is, I guess, whether it makes political sense for some people, because it's been a very tough lift for a lot of people in Washington. John Abraham, we'll link you to some of his research at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
And again, John Abraham is a professor of thermal sciences at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. He's co-author of the new study on ocean temperatures rising faster than anyone thought. Well, as of the beginning of this month, January 1st, all hospitals across the country have been required to post their prices online, prices for the services, procedures, and pills that the hospital provides. It's part of the Trump administration's effort for greater transparency when it comes to healthcare costs. Joining us now is Julie Appleby of Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. So these posted price lists are called charge masters. What exactly are they? What costs do they include?
So a charge master is basically a list of all of the goods and services that a hospital provides and its prices that they have set.
But these are not what you as a consumer would pay, because oftentimes your insurance company would take care of at least most of the costs of these things.
That's exactly it, which is why a lot of folks think this is not very helpful information. It's interesting. There's a lot of things in there. But most consumers, most of the time, are not paying charge master prices.
I see in the story that you did about this that there's a hospital in Hampton Roads, Virginia, where they found a $307 charge for something called a Lay-Kloss HND/FT less than 2.5 cm. What is that?
What is that? That is a very good question. That actually is the charge for a small suture in surgery. But how would you know that? That's part of the problem with these lists, is they are lists. They are on Excel files. They have a lot of abbreviations. Some of it's pretty clear. Like, you can see that a charge for a semi-private room is X amount. But things like that, you've really got to Google it, or have to know the code, or have to have gone to medical school to figure out just what is it. So that's part of the reason why this is not useful.
Well, what's the reasoning behind this requirement then, that these prices exist?
The Affordable Care Act required it, and the Trump administration built upon it by saying that instead of having to ask for it, let's make hospitals post it. It's part of a larger transparency movement. And don't get me wrong, a lot of the experts are saying this is actually useful information. It's interesting information because it does a number of things. It does expose the wide variation in pricing. So hospitals in the same town offering the same service set charges that can be wildly different, you know, from hundreds of dollars to tens of thousands of dollars of difference. So that's one thing it highlights. It highlights this large variation in prices around the country. And it shows also how much more hospitals charge than they're paid. So there are other information online where you can see how much Medicare reimburses, for example. So you can see that the hospital charges are often well above that. And finally, I think everyone is affected by charges, even though you might not pay charges as an individual consumer. Charges are often the basis for which private insurers base their negotiations with hospitals for how much they're going to pay. So rising prices on these charge master lists can translate into higher prices paid by insurers and therefore higher premiums. So that's another thing that the experts are telling me, hey, this might not be useful for individual consumers, but sort of in the great scheme of things, you can see a little bit more about how our health system does and doesn't work and sort of the opaque nature of this pricing.
What about when there's a discrepancy? You point out an example at the University of California San Francisco Hospital where there are two charge master line items for vaginal childbirth. One is $5,497. The other is $12,632.
And there's no explanation about what the difference is. That's part of the problem with these lists. We don't know. Another place, the Minnesota Mayo Clinic, for example, has two listings, one for labor and delivery level one short, and that would cost $3,000 approximately. Another one is for labor and delivery long for $5,000. But what's long? What's short? I mean, who knows? I don't know. Most consumers looking at that aren't going to know. It's what the hospital bills in their coding. And if you're not a coding expert, you would have no idea.
Was there any pushback by the hospitals over these requirements, or is this information that they're okay having out in the public?
You know, most hospitals even admit that this is not very useful for consumers. They put these little disclaimers before this information saying, you know, it's probably not what you're going to pay. That said, they didn't oppose it that much. They're required to do this. What they really do oppose is being required to show how much they accept from private insurers. They say that's a trade secret. They say that would be a problem. But that's exactly what some consumer advocates say needs to be out there, because then if you get one of these balance bills, which are where you are out of network and you have to pay the difference between what your insurer paid and these charges, then you would have a little bit better idea of what the average price is that those hospitals will accept in a region, and you might be able to negotiate with them for that, which is going to be lower in most cases than these charges. But the hospitals really don't want that information out there. So they really would not want to be required to show how much they accept from various private insurers for these services.
And they don't right now have to do that?
Generally, they do not.
Hmm. Why do you think that is, that they're required to give these other numbers but not those? More pushback probably from them.
There would be more pushback because they'll say that this will affect their negotiations with insurers. If they're sitting down at the table with an insurer to negotiate rates and that insurer knows how much the hospital accepts from all their other competitor insurers in town, hospitals are going to argue that that puts them at a competitive disadvantage.
So for our listeners who may have had a procedure or may be going into the hospital at some point soon, what should they do with this information? Should they go and look online and try to get these charge masters?
Well, for your insured consumers, I would say the first thing they should do is talk to their insurer, because they need to find out what their deductible is, how much they paid of it this year, how much their charges are. If they're not insured, they should definitely look at these charges if they have a choice of hospitals and see which ones have the lower charges. They can then also compare that information with some other websites online. Groups like Fair Health or Healthcare Blue Book, they list things that are average sort of payments made in various regions. And it's not exact. It's not going to be per hospital. It's going to be by zip code or geographic area. But it would give them a little bit more of an idea of sort of the average charge. And then maybe they can make an arrangement with the hospital if they are going to be out of network or they are uninsured.
That is Julie Appleby, senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Julie, thanks.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Washington, D.C.'s first and oldest synagogue has a new home after it was rolled down the street to make way for a new development. As Michaela LaFrac from member station WAMU reports, the modest brick building was worth saving because of its long and eclectic history.
Picture this, a nearly 150-year-old, 270-ton building crawling down a street in the nation's capital. No, it wasn't an act of God. This week, the former synagogue was hoisted onto a truck bed and moved a block to 3rd and F Streets in the city's downtown. Before the move started, a local rabbi recited a traveler's prayer in Hebrew. The building was reinforced with steel beams, mounted onto more than 60 wheels, and rolled down the street at a turtle's pace, 1 mile per hour. It's changing locations to make way for a new set of mixed-use buildings. The synagogue will then be repurposed into the Capitol Jewish Museum, which will explore the history of Jewish life in Washington. It'll have artifacts, like one of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's lace collars. There will also be an exhibit on the synagogue itself. It was built in 1876. President Ulysses S. Grant was at its dedication. Kara Blonde is the museum's executive director.
It was the first synagogue built in Washington. It was home to the Addis Israel congregation. And for the first 30 years of its life, it was this remarkable little community.
Then the congregation moved on to a bigger space, and the building was put up for sale. Blonde said it switched ownership many times over the next 6 decades.
It became a deli and a barbershop and a barbecue restaurant and a bicycle store. It really kind of melted into the fabric, the urban fabric of Washington.
In the 1960s, the city needed the location, so the Jewish community rallied to get the building historic landmark status. Then, a couple named Lillian and Albert Small paid to have it moved three blocks in 1969. Their daughter, Carolyn, was there to watch.
It was hot. That's what I remember.
She's 91 now and came out to watch it move again.
It was exciting, just like this is. Isn't that fabulous to see it move like that?
After its first move, the building served as the headquarters of a small Jewish museum. Then, in 2016, it was moved again, 60 feet, and it was left on wheels. When the synagogue's journey finally came to an end this week, D.C. delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton came out to watch.
And I've come to say to those of you who keep moving our synagogue around, you can keep moving it all you want to, but you're never going to move it out of the District of Columbia. For God's sake, the third move? This has got to be the last move. We insist that this be its permanent home.
Nearby, people listened to klezmer music and looked at renderings of the future museum. Despite all the struggles of relocating a historic building, there is one upside to this final move. The synagogue now faces east again, in line with Jewish tradition. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela Lefrak in Washington.
And on this 21st day of the government shutdown, let's get the perspective of an internationally recognized expert in negotiations. William Ury is co-founder of Harvard's Program on Negotiation and co-author of the book Getting to Yes. He joins us from Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to Here and Now.
It's a great pleasure, Jeremy.
So you're one of the world's foremost experts on negotiations. What do you make of the state of the negotiations around the government shutdown right now?
Well, I don't know if I'm an expert. I'm a student. I've been studying for many decades. But you always have something to learn here. What I make of it is it's a classic, win-lose contest, which almost inevitably, in my experience, ends up in lose-lose outcomes. You know, each side thinks they're going to win, but neither side's going to back down. So both sides end up losing. And actually, the people who lose the most are us, the citizens, mm-hmm. the community, the federal employees, all the people who are suffering, who will be suffering even more from the federal breakdown. And that, to me, is the key in the negotiation. The secret to solving this is not just the parties, it's us.
Is there a way for both sides to at least feel like they have a win and come to a conclusion and reach a deal?
I believe so. That's probably the only way it's going to end up is what I like to do in negotiation is I like to work backwards. You start with their victory speeches. You know, you write President Trump's victory speech in which he says to his base, I won. Mm-hmm. And you write Nancy Pelosi's victory speech in which he says to her base, I won. And then you work back from that and say, okay, how do we arrive at a deal that has enough in it for both sides that we can get on with our business and the federal government can resume?
In your book, you write that the parties in a negotiation should focus on interests, not positions. It seems like President Trump is doing the opposite, fixating on the border wall. Democrats keep talking about the more general interest of border security.
That's true. There's a tendency in all of us to, in any negotiation, to focus on the position, the thing we say we want, the very concrete thing, in this case, the wall. The key in negotiation, successful negotiation, is to look behind that position for what are the underlying interests. In other words, the underlying needs or concerns. And in this particular case, it might be border security. How do we keep America safe? Immigration. How do we handle immigration? There are a lot of underlying interests. How do we deal with the people who are already here, the dreamers and so on? And if we can get into a conversation, a negotiation in which we address those interests mm-hmm. that actually both sides actually share, we all share. And if we can have that kind of problem-solving, creative dialogue, I'm sure we can find solutions that are good for everyone.
You also write about the need to manage emotions in a negotiation and to be soft on the people, hard on the problem. President Trump doesn't seem to be doing that either. Now, he denies that he slammed his hands down on the table and walked out of a room with the leaders of Congress, but they say he did.
Well, yeah, the secret in negotiation to me is, it's almost like you draw a line in your head between the people and the problem so that simultaneously you can be soft on the people you know, build the relationship while you remain very hard in solving the problem. In fact, the harder you need to be on the problem, usually the softer you need to be on the people. If the people, their emotions, their egos, and so on are not going to get in the way of solving the problem.
The other thing is that your book comes from the point of view that in every negotiation, you have to start with the assumption that both sides are interested in reaching an agreement. Do you think that that's the case here?
Well, I do think that eventually both sides will reach an agreement. Mm-hmm. And the question is how much pain does there have to be? And the pain is primarily borne by us, by the American people, and by particularly those who don't have their jobs right now or are not receiving some critical government service. To me, that's the key in any negotiation is right now what we need to do is we need to be able to step back, step to the balcony. I call it, step to the balcony. In other words, a place of calm, a place of perspective, a place where we're not reacting, a place where we can see the big picture, we can focus on the prize. Clearly, both parties in this case are not on the balcony. But what we need to do, we, the third side, there's always, we always think of negotiation as two-sided. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's Democrats versus Republicans, the president versus Pelosi. But the key is there's a third side, which is the surrounding community, which is us. In this case, both sides, they're playing to us. And in this case, the American people are being held hostage by this negotiation. And if we can learn to speak up, including this media, including you, including the people who are listening right now, if we make our voices known to our members of Congress, to in social media and so on, we will speed up the process because they'll see that both sides will see that they're losing more by playing the blame game than by engaging in a negotiation that addresses the genuine interests at stake.
I just read your book for the first time, but the people that I've talked to about it know the term that's in it, which is BATNA. I had never heard that before, but BATNA is the best alternative to a negotiated agreement, which is to say that when you're in a negotiation, you should have something in your back pocket that says, if I don't get an agreement, I'm going to do this, and I'll be perfectly happy with that. In this case, it seems like President Trump's BATNA is this executive action to build the wall without congressional approval. As you look at it, do the Democrats have a BATNA?
Yeah, their BATNA might be, for example, to block that, because it's of questionable legality, as I understand, and you can file lawsuits, and there are a lot of things that can be done. Every negotiation takes place within the shadow of the BATNA, of the alternative, what each side sees as their alternative. And the aim of negotiation is to develop agreements that are better for each side than their perceived alternative. And that's the challenge at this point. Right now, each side is exercising their BATNA by engaging in this contest, this contest of wills. It will come to a stop eventually. And the question is how long? And the key factor in determining that, I think, is us, is if we make our voices known, then the game needs to change. It needs to change from a win-lose contest to one in which you look for mutual benefit and particularly benefit for the American citizens.
This week also saw President Trump's first Oval Office address to the nation, part of the goal of that being to reframe the debate over funding the government into talk of a humanitarian crisis. Is that a common negotiation tactic to try to shift the terms of the debate, and do you think it worked in this case?
It is a common tactic. Reframing is one of the greatest powers you have as a negotiation. Negotiation isn't just bargaining. There's a strategic communication. In this case, particularly because it's a political situation, and each side is communicating to the nation. That was his attempt to reframe. I don't know. I haven't seen the polls on that of how successful that was. But the real thing is to reframe this from a win lose arm wrestle contest into a genuine negotiation exercise to deal with the interests at stake and let the government get back to work.
If you could give negotiation advice right now to President Trump, what would it be?
I would be look to see, begin to see, write my own victory speech. What do I need to be able to say to tell my base that I won? Write the other side's victory speech. And then try to design a process so that we can find a way out of the situation in which each side emerges intact and ready to fight another battle if it need be the next day. But let's move on from this. Let's really get past this imbroglio, because it's going to hurt everyone, and it's hurting it'll hurt everyone even more. And when there's a real crisis, imagine something happens, like there's a national security threat, something like this. We have to wake up, come to our senses. We have to come together. And in fact, to me, this is a wake-up call for all of us. There's a polarization, a very dangerous polarization in the country right now, which if we don't address it and come together and speak up, the third side, the community, then things could get a lot worse.
Finally, how different is it to do a negotiation like this in public, in the press, you know, instead of just doing it behind closed doors?
Very difficult. It's really difficult to negotiate in a fishbowl where you're in front of cameras and so on, as we've seen. The best way to do this, to me, if I was President Trump, is I would appoint a couple of what I call wizards, people whom I really trust, ask the speaker to appoint a couple of wizards too. They go off somewhere and they brainstorm, they look at the interests, they really try to figure out, they write those victory speeches, and they come back and make recommendations to both parties that allow for an off-ramp, allow for what I call building a golden bridge, making it easy for both sides to back down in some sense, to back away towards a solution that works for everyone.
Let's see if it happens. William Ury, co-founder of Harvard's Program of Negotiation and author of the book Getting to Yes, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure, Jeremy.
The print and broadcast news outlet that covers the Muscogee Nation in Oklahoma was once considered the gold standard for press freedom in Indian country. But last November, the tribe's chief and council passed legislation that put Muscogee media under the tribe's executive branch. And last week, the chief vetoed a bill that would have restored the newsroom's editorial independence. Journalist Sterling Cosper resigned as manager of Muscogee Media in protest, and he joins me now. Sterling, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me, Peter.
And as far as you were told, what were the reasons for your news organization being placed under the control of the nation's executive branch?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I will say that the reasons have kind of changed. The first stated reason by one of the council reps that was a co-sponsor of the repeal was that there was just flat too much negative coverage. The chief that signed the bill just recently did the veto. In his veto message, we're hearing a lot of stuff about financial concerns.
Well, Chief James Floyd, who you referred to there, says Muscogee Media remains independent. He says he's dedicated to a free press and that really this is about ensuring departmental accountability and efficiency. You must not be convinced because you decided to quit anyway.
Yes. Well, I mean, I guess I'd ask for the larger audience, if the president said that, would you believe him?
Because you're making the point that this is like the New York Times falling under the purview of the White House.
Sure. Sure. You know, it's not immediately equatable. We do receive tribal funds. But nonetheless, I mean, to say that it's independent news when the managing editor sits under Tourism and Recreation, which sits under the Secretary of the Nation and Commerce, all those people answer to the chief. So if he wants someone fired, he can do it. And that's what people need to understand.
Okay, so some journalistic problems potentially there. But when this organization was editorial independent, you all shed some pretty important light on stories there. Mismanagement of funds by the tribal government, deficiencies in the tribal housing program. What do your news consumers have to lose now that this outlet has lost its editorial freedom? I assume there's not a lot of other news outlets working on these types of stories.
Well, that's the key point. Now it's basically sitting on outside media to find a story big enough that really warrants coverage. But it's important to understand we're citizens, we understand the government, and also we have our finger on the pulse of the nation all day long.
Yeah. Now, at its heart, this is a local story, but the Native American Journalist Association conducted a survey of Native journalists last year where they found that a lack of editorial control was seen to be a major threat to tribal media across the board. So how big of a problem is this across all of Indian country?
So I hate to make an overall generalization that all tribes are the same, but, you know, a lot of them are in a similar circumstance as us, in a sense that outside media is not full-time dedicated to covering what's going on with their tribes. also because of maybe how their societies are set up, they really don't have a good economy or whatever to support a robust department that reports on the government. So this is kind of the reason behind some of these tribes that do have tribally funded media outlets. When a scandal breaks, all of a sudden they see an outside media department covering a story that their media department isn't. You know, that's what happened with us. And that's why folks started looking at, well, what is the nature of the press? And maybe should we do something different to make sure that they're in a position of protection to where they can properly cover what's going on with our tribe day to day?
Well, part of the problem is, and you've hinted at this, is that gathering news is expensive, and that in many cases, tribal nations are really the only entities that will fund a media outlet that's focused on Indian country. So what's the solution to that? There's not a lot of ad revenue out there.
Well, I'm glad you said it, because that is exactly the case. I mean, people are going to buy advertising in an outlet that really kind of pertains to them or their customers at the end of the day, you know, and there's not a lot of broad shareholders all the time that are robust enough to finance that kind of operation. So, I mean, yeah, that as far as what the answer is, I really don't know. You know, that's the thing. We had a free press bill that structurally separated us from the government. You know, at the end of the day, we just need to decide that this is important for the tribe. And if they see the importance of this, we need to find a way, or at least all agree, that it needs adequate funding to do its job.
Meanwhile, those protections that you mentioned are gone. You are out of a job because you've resigned. Are you out of journalism? What's next for you?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, that's what I'd like to do. However, you know, at the end of the day, I just need to get some income coming in. But I always said, you know, even if I resigned, if my title doesn't reflect that I'm a journalist, just the act of protesting an unethical journalistic model still made me a journalist, whether I was doing that day to day or not.
Well, good luck to you, Sterling Cosper, former manager of Muskogee Media. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.